Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May I please the Court? This morning, I wish to address two issues from this multifaceted case. Number one, the right remedy is to follow the general rule and remand for failure to make the required findings and conclusions. And number two, the big issue that caused the four-way divide in the Southern District below and was transferred here for this Court's review is on appellate jurisdiction and on required lines of sua sponte inquiry. As to the first issue, this Court should follow the general rule and remand this case. It's undisputed that the motion court failed to make the required findings of fact and conclusions of law and just denied the motion without any explanation, leaving the Southern District and now this Court in the dark as to why the motion was denied. Findings and conclusions cannot be supplied by implication nor furnished by appellate courts because that would be providing an impliedly de novo review and contrary to what the legislature provided that this court's rule would be under the statute. There's
no
applicable.
What about our rule that you need to object to the failure to make findings within 30 days?
Well, in this case, Mr. Mercer was not notified for 179 days that his motion had been denied. So at the time that he finally was notified after requesting twice the court to tell him what had happened, it had been beyond the 30 days that he could file such a motion, and if there were a judgment for purposes of Rule 7807C, the trial court would have lost jurisdiction of it at that time.
So you're saying it would be inequitable to apply that rule in this situation because he didn't have notice within 30 days?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the rules require that he should have gotten notice.
They do indeed. He was incarcerated, so he actually was receiving cancer treatments at a different prison and had put the motion court on notice of his transfer, and they just did not notify him as to what had happened to his motion. The big issue that divided the Southern District four ways was about appellate jurisdiction and mandatory lines of sua sponte inquiry. The majority raised sua sponte the issue of final judgment and dismissed the appeal for a lack of final judgment due to finding that the denomination and signature requirements of Rule 74.01A were not met when the trial court denied the motion. The majority discussed the concerns of the concurrences and dissent about the issue, but said it didn't matter whether they were dismissing the motion out of jurisdictional issues or prudential concerns. There were two concurrences. One concurring judge said that it was being dismissed for jurisdictional reasons, and the other concurring judge said it was for prudential concerns. They did have jurisdiction. And finally, the dissent said that in light of this court's holding in JCW versus Basilica, it's inappropriate to raise sua sponte whether or not there was a final judgment in the case because it doesn't affect the Article 5 jurisdiction of the appellate court either way, and therefore they shouldn't be analyzing that issue to begin with.
They only have seven judges. How can they have so many opinions?
Yes. Four opinions by seven judges. So I believe that the dissent was right in to the extent that JCW's reasoning should apply to appellate court jurisdiction.
Well, the language in Wysakala specifically says it's addressing the circuit court jurisdiction. It does not indicate that it is addressing appellate jurisdiction. What is your response to that?
I think this case is an excellent opportunity to clarify that and extend it to appellate court jurisdiction because the reasoning under that decision of this court applies here as well. The rule 7401 does not affect the Article 5 appellate jurisdiction of the court to review cases. So that was part of jurisdiction prior to the JCW case. Final judgment was discussed in terms of jurisdiction, and appellate courts have to address sua sponte whether or not they have jurisdiction to hear a case. But whether or not there's a final judgment, that was not something that was raised by the parties at all. This was brought up by the appellate court on its own, and without any need to do so.
But don't we have a number of cases in which we've sua sponte raised the issue of final judgment for jurisdictional purposes? And if we accept your argument, would we have to be overruling those numerous cases that we've done so in?
Since the passing, since JCW came out, there have not been that many cases. There's two that I'm aware of, and neither of them are analogous here. In one case, the Nuega, we have really hard to pronounce cases involved with this. The Nuega decision, that actually involved jurisdiction still being at the trial court level, because there was a statute that said you had to seek a de novo review of an associate court's ruling before you could go appeal. So that's a different issue. And then there was recently a decision by this court involving 7401B, which is a different animal than 7401A. And I think due to the unique circumstances of that case and a new rule being passed with the PCRs and attaching pro se claims to them, I just don't think it's analogous in controlling in this case.
Counsel, I know you're analogizing the language in the Constitution that says appellate court shall have jurisdiction of all cases which are not placed in the all appellate cases that are not placed in the jurisdiction of this court for all appeals. If I understand, that's your basis of saying the appellate court has jurisdiction?
Yes, under Article 5, it has appellate jurisdiction.
But it's so it says which court or who has appellate jurisdiction, the appellate courts, unless it specifically gives this court original jurisdiction of the appeal. But it doesn't say when. I mean, it's different than Webb and different than the circuit court language because it says all cases not that don't go on appeal to this court go to the Court of Appeals, so we know they'll have jurisdiction of those cases. But that doesn't address or give you a right to appeal at any time. It doesn't address when you can appeal. It's just if you appeal, that's where it goes, isn't it?
Right. The right to appeal is actually statutory.
So why can't the statutes provide for that you have to have a final and our rules also, since we can address procedural issues if we're not barred by the Constitution, can't we set up by rule when you can file an appeal and require a final judgment?
We could, and...
And we do, don't we?
In some instances, but not here. 547035 does not require there to be a final judgment.
But that's a different issue. Then you're talking generally. First, you're saying we can't consider our own authority unless it's raised. And if we say by rule that you have to have a final judgment, do we not have authority to enforce our rules?
Well, the court does have supervisory authority over all courts.
The issue is... The statute determines who may appeal and when they may appeal by requiring that there has to be an adverse ruling on particular matters or there has to be a final judgment. The final judgment is kind of a catch-all phrase as opposed to saying you have to have a final judgment when it's a PCR case or something. Is that distinction significant?
I'm not sure that it is because there's actually a provision under the general statute on appealing that allows for an appeal from a special order after a final judgment, which would be applicable here. I think if you don't already have the right to appeal under 547037, which I would argue that we do.
So your argument in your brief is sometimes it has to be a final judgment from which an appeal can lie, but other times it is a ruling on an order that is not designated by statute as a final judgment.
That's correct. That would be applicable here. We have Mr. Mercer is aggrieved by a final judgment in a criminal case. There's only one judgment that he's aggrieved by. This is a collateral attack that's required by statute to be filed within that same case number. So it's really an order that he's appealing from denying his motion. Similarly, PCRs, those are orders, not judgments, that are appealed from in post-conviction cases.
Opposing counsel notes that our PCR rules, post-conviction rules, specifically say that the orders shall be treated as final judgments in under 24035 and 2915, but the DNA rule and statute don't say that. statute doesn't say that. Should that make a difference?
I don't believe so. Because 547037 says that an appeal may be taken from the trial court's or the sentencing court's decision. So I think that's enough to trigger it at that time. We know whether it's not that hard to tell whether or not they've denied the motion when they've denied the motion.
And I know you know opposing counsel says that only applies if there's been testing and a final ruling. Can you address why you think that's not the case and it applies to any ruling on a DNA motion?
Because 547035 and 037 should be read in pari materia with each other, and it would be absurd to interpret these statutes that have been around 15 years, and every appellate court and this court have issued opinions with regard to denials of 547035 motions that the legislature has acquiesced to. It would not make any sense to rule all of a sudden that if someone is claiming innocence in prison and says there's evidence of my innocence that needs to be tested, and the motion court denies them their request to test it, that they get no right to appeal at all. That's not the purpose of the statute, and it's not reading it using our rules of statutory interpretation.
Counselor, assuming that movement in a case like this was properly notified of the trial court's ruling and received an order, it either did or didn't say, it was assumed for sake of argument that it said this is order overruling and this is a final judgment. Would you agree with me that that it makes sense to apply 7807C?
I agree.
And that if there is no request for findings of fact, that they would be governed by 7301, found in accordance with the judgment.
I would agree to save judicial resources overall, that prospectively it would not be a bad idea to have 7807C be required just so prisoners point out to circuit court judges around the state when they fail to comply with the statute and issue findings and conclusions, but it wouldn't be fair to apply that requirement to Mr. Mercer, who incidentally in his August letter said to the clerk, I have not received findings of fact or conclusions of law, and he underlined that phrase. So, I mean,
It appears he knew he was entitled to them whenever he received notice that his motion had been overruled.
And then he still didn't receive them, so he did the only recourse that he had at that point was to seek a motion to file for an appeal out of time, which was granted by the Southern District below.
Your time is up. We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Appeal is by statute in Missouri, and here the statute does not allow an appeal. In January of 2001, the Southern District ruled against me in In Re Salcedo and held that a similar special statutory proceeding did not allow an appeal. That same year, the legislature passed this legislation, obviously knowing that Salcedo was there, and I say obviously because the legislature also changed the SVP statute in response to Salcedo. So
did that statute require findings of fact and conclusions of law?
No, it did not. But I don't think that's relevant to the analysis
can
in that statute.
Remind us what that did?
In Salcedo? Mm-hmm. Salcedo had a provision in the sexually violent predator statute that said that there could be an appeal of the final determination as to whether someone was a sexually violent predator. And the court said that since the legislature said you could have an appeal in that instance, that you couldn't have an appeal as to any other step in the process outlined in the sexually violent predator statute. That's exactly what we have here.
What's the purpose of compelling findings of fact and conclusions of law if it's not for an appeal?
The same purpose that this court fulfills when this court writes an opinion. It notifies the parties as to the court's reasoning, the basis for the court's decision.
That's not true for the requirement to be on the record. What's the point of that if there's not an appeal? Doesn't it have to be on the record in a hearing?
If there is a test and then there's a dispute about the result of the test, that has to be on a hearing. That's 037. There is an appeal right there.
There's a couple of different places for hearings. There's an early hearing to decide if you should have later.
There can be an early hearing.
And so does that have to be on the record, that earlier hearing?
No. The first step is the court looks at the document, at the petition. And here, if you look at the petition, it was insufficient in a variety of ways.
That's a different issue, I know, but that we're dealing with the.
Well, but then that leads to a findings and conclusions statement. And then the court is supposed to look at the documents before it other than the petition. And if it says there's not a reason, then it's supposed to do findings and conclusions. Then the third option, if it finds that there may be some basis on the petition and on the documents before it, then it can issue an order to show cause. And then it looks at everything that comes in and decides whether there's a basis for a hearing.
So we just have a special concern in these cases that we want people to understand why they lost that we don't have in any other fact situation?
Because this whole thing is an act of grace by the General Assembly. There is no constitutional requirement the General Assembly set up this system. The General Assembly set it up. They set it up in a way that gives the trial court 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 instances in which it can.
Well, they based it on a rule we adopted prior to the statute, which was almost identical.
Well, that may be true, but the legislature did this to say to people, look, there ought to be a way in which people can address that, at least in an instance, which this isn't one, where someone puts forth in a petition a basis for actually getting testing where the testing actually would be meaningful, which in this instance is not likely to be true.
But the hearing as to whether or not there should be testing, the statute specifically requires it to be on the record.
Well,
and that the ruling on whether or not there is a hearing should, the court has to make findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Well, but the findings of fact, conclusion of law provision applies even in the down the paths where there is no hearing. That it's not just if there's a hearing.
Exactly.
That's
the point.
Every result here leads to findings and conclusion. But I don't think you can read that to mean that the General Assembly is saying this is not like Salcedo. So assuming that there is an appeal right, then the next question is whether there's a final judgment. And here there is no final judgment.
Does there have to be when there is express authority to appeal from a ruling on a motion? As opposed to relying on the provision that allows you to appeal from a final judgment.
Under this court's rules, yes, there has to be. That's the way that it normally operates. But here, that doesn't happen because the provision for appeal is under 037. This is not an 037 case.
Can you answer Ms. Bukowski's argument that it's at the end of 037, it just says an appeal may be taken from the court's findings and conclusions as in other civil cases. It doesn't say if the court orders testing, it doesn't limit it. I know it's at the end of 6, but it's at the end of the entire two sections that discuss DNA testing and when you're entitled to a hearing.
Well, it's at the end, that's only the second sentence in that section, and that first sentence of that section is a reference to the hearing that is in that section. I don't think that you can fairly read that provision to say, oh, and by the way, that also means a hearing that never gets you to this section is also covered. In that sense, it is no different than the Salcedo precedent.
If we agree that the appeal is proper, but yet we agree with you that no findings of facts, conclusions of law are required, then how would this court review the sufficiency of appellant's motion?
Well, it is possible to, if there is an appeal allowed, then it is possible to come to this court or the Court of Appeals and say there was a requirement for findings and conclusions and it wasn't made. And although I think that the rule says you've got to ask for that timeline, I understand the circumstance here is different and hopefully unique, that they didn't ask for it. There's nothing in this statute, in response to Judge Fisher's question, that says you have to ask in advance. So if you get past that, then I think that the appropriate method is to say to the trial court, there have to be findings and conclusions, which could have been done by a writ petition.
But without them, how do we review?
Without them?
Yes.
Well, I think that the proper course here, and again, we have a timeliness problem here because of the notice, the proper course would have been to go to the Court of Appeals for a writ and say, tell the trial court to enter findings and conclusions.
But the case was already over. Did the trial court say
that? That's the problem here is that it was over, and so it becomes a really, I hope, unique circumstance.
But you argue in your brief that from the face of the petition, it is, as a matter of law, it is deficient.
Right.
And does not. So under the circumstances, if the court agrees with you that the petition is deficient on its face, can the court enter a ruling, or does the court have to send back for findings and conclusions of law?
No, the court could enter a ruling under the rule that allows this court to do what the trial court should do. And if you look at the whole concept in 547.0352, I mean, again and again and again, it fails. Let me start with actually the second point. You don't get this DNA testing unless identity was an issue in the trial. There was no question of identity at issue in this trial.
Well, they say they allege in the petition that there was. Is that?
The question of identity? Everyone knew who the girl was.
On its face, it alleges identity was at issue.
The facts alleged in the petition show that it was not at issue. The facts alleged in the petition show that DNA testing had already been done before trial. The facts alleged in the petition show that that they asked for DNA testing, that they knew about it, that they knew the evidence was there. And this whole statutory scheme is not intended to create a method by which, if you didn't take up a question of DNA in the original trial, you can do it later. These folks concede, this man concedes on the face of the petition that he and his counsel knew that they could get DNA testing, they knew about the evidence was available, and they didn't appeal the denial of getting DNA testing.
And that goes to a separate requirement that they have to show that DNA testing was not reasonably available to them. You say the face of the petition shows that it was.
And you have the requirement that there has to be a reasonable probability that the movement would not have been convicted if exculpatory results had been obtained. But what would be the exculpatory results? We knew that this girl was his daughter or his stepdaughter, and both of those are covered by the incest statute. So what difference could it make? On the face of the document, he could not get past the first step. The trial court should never have asked for a response from the prosecutor, because the document itself was fatally deficient on its face.
Can you, turning to the jurisdiction issue, do you think we have jurisdiction in the, or are you saying because there's no final judgment, we don't have
jurisdiction? I'm saying because there's no final judgment, I'm not just saying you don't have jurisdiction. Okay, we did not engage in this in the brief, and the reason, frankly, is that most of the time it doesn't matter to us on appeal. And here's why. When I'm in the trial court, I have to care about the JCW effect, because if something isn't jurisdictional, it's waivable. So let's take here this question of whether it was a final judgment and apply that. Well, what do you mean it's waivable? Does that mean that if I file a brief in the appellate court and I don't address whether there was a final judgment, the Court of Appeals now has authority or jurisdiction, however you want to phrase, I guess, authority to proceed? I
mean, that's what opposing counsel's arguing.
Couldn't that lead to this problem? There are lots of cases where both lawyers on each side would like to get a writ and it's denied.
Yes.
And so what lawyers would do is they would get some order that isn't a final judgment that we all know is a locatory, and they would just agree to make the Court of Appeals hear it, and our Constitution doesn't provide for advisory opinions. We're supposed to have one appeal at the end of the whole thing, and the whole system could be totally gamed by both sides who want a ruling and honestly don't care what the ruling is, but it will just change.
I see counsel out there taking notes of how to do it.
Well,
The
next time I'm before you in a few weeks, it's a case that may be a little bit like that, where everybody wants the court to take it. It's a problem.
My purpose for asking the question is, this court has to have jurisdiction, or else we're just having a nice conversation, but we can't issue an opinion that's binding on anybody.
So
we must have jurisdiction of the appeal. But counsel's point was, and I think Judge Fisher's comments may have addressed it, if we do have jurisdiction, as we have to if it's filed here from a circuit court on a transfer from the Court of Appeals, do we have authority to sua sponte look at whether there's a final judgment? Opposing counsel argues that unless it's a jurisdictional matter, it's waivable. Judge Fisher's given some good reasons why it shouldn't be waivable, but since our rules don't really address that, can we, but traditionally we have said we can sua sponte look at it, how does that fit with modern interpretations of jurisdiction?
Well, so let me put it this way. This court and the Court of Appeals have jurisdiction to hear appeals. Appeals can exist only where allowed by statute. The statute provides, setting aside the possibility that this one is unique, at least at 512, the statute provides that we have to have a judgment, and this court defines final judgment. That means that there is no appeal over which to take jurisdiction until there is a final judgment. At least that's the way I would deal with it. It's not something you can waive because it isn't actually appealable. It can't.
But we have to have jurisdiction to say that. So we have jurisdiction of the appeal,
well,
but not of the merits?
You have jurisdiction to say that in the same way that you have jurisdiction when someone brings up any kind of appeal to say we can't take that for reason A, B, C, or D. Sometimes your jurisdiction allows you only to respond to what you're given, and the only response can be we can't hear it. But no, I that's the way I would think of it, is that you have jurisdiction over appeals. The statute and the rules define what can be an appeal. The statute and the rule generally say that it has to be a final judgment. If it's not a final judgment, there is no appeal over which you can take jurisdiction. All you could do is say we don't have jurisdiction.
Well, your right to appeal that you have isn't lost if that rule is enforced that way.
It's not lost.
Because once the final judgment is entered, the clock restarts.
Right, because it's still pending in the trial court.
Except you're saying here under the DNA statute, you don't have a right to appeal, so it is lost. You're saying you can
never
appeal.
Well, it's lost, but not for that reason. I mean, it's not lost because it never existed in the first place.
And why isn't this a special order after judgment? Because it has to be filed in the criminal case, and it's an order.
Well,
under 512.
You mean why would that mean that it could be a final?
Why isn't it appealable as an order after final judgment? A special order after final judgment. Sorry.
Well, there's no statute the statute here, I think, read as under Salcedo.
The general appellate statute, doesn't it say you can appeal special orders after final judgment?
In the general statute?
Uh-huh, 512.020.
Yes, and I don't.
And opposing counsel.
It's possible it could be one of those.
Opposing counsel invoked that in her argument that if not otherwise appealable, it's appealable as a special order after final judgment because it has to be filed in the criminal case, which has already had a final judgment, and it's an order, so it must be a special order after final judgment.
That would mean that in a juvenile or family law case, everything that comes after the initial judgment, when someone goes back in, everything is appealable all the time because they're all orders after final judgment. I don't think that's the way the court looks at this. This may be filed in the original case, but it isn't the original case. It is a separate item provided by a separate statute. The mere fact that we say file it in that particular case, I don't believe makes it an order in that case for purposes of that.
In fact, it's another confusing circumstance by the fact that it's filed in a criminal case, but the legislature has determined civil rules apply where applicable.
Because
and where it's right for appeal says it shall be as another civil case. It's very odd.
Because it's like habeas, which is civil. Thank you.
Thank you.
I would say that an order
with you step back just from the mic a little bit because it's echoing. Thanks.
I would say an order with regard to a prisoner claiming innocence and requesting DNA testing is a special order that gets made with regard to that. This prisoner was denied without explanation his request for DNA testing. All they had to do was explain why they were denying his motion, and they didn't do that much. And to find an exception to the general rule that you need to remand will do nothing but condone and encourage bad behavior by motion courts.
If there isn't a final judgment and it goes back to the circuit court, could your client not ask for leave to amend the motion to correct some of the deficiencies that are claimed by the state?
He He could, but he has not had much luck without guidance from this court and getting the circuit court to do much of anything so far. I mean, he's stuck in prison. They're not even notifying him as to what's happening. I think remand is very important in this case for Mr. Mercer to compel the motion courts and future motion courts for all of these motions to go ahead and do their jobs at the outset so that we're not in appellate courts having all kinds of extra judicial resources being squandered.
Do the state argues that the motion is deficient on its face, and it certainly appears that it does not make allegations that are required by the statute.
I disagree with that. First of all, identity is at issue. That's been decided in State v. Ruth in 2008. When a defendant goes to trial, identity is at issue. That matter has been resolved.
And so I thought, does it matter for charging this case whether he is the father or stepfather? Is he guilty if he's the stepfather?
The statute just says whether or not it would be reasonably likely that he would be found guilty. The jury instruction said related by blood. I think at the very least a hearing would be warranted to explore these issues, and what he did assert on the face of his motion is adequate for these purposes, that he asked the state for DNA testing. It was made unavailable to him. There's been two cases with regard to that requiring a hearing. I believe it's Fields and Weeks.
He didn't have counsel at trial?
He had counsel at trial, and his pro se motion, which he could amend upon remand with leave of the court, indicates that his counsel was part of the state denying him the DNA testing. But given the holdings of Fields and Weeks as to how to give, you know, liberal interpretation to these pro se prisoner motions, I don't see that as any reason to go down the path where we're doing the motion court's job for them and wasting appellate judicial resources. I think the best thing that we can do when they just deny a motion with no findings and conclusions to save judicial resources is to immediately remand it and tell them to make findings and conclusions so that we're not for years here at two different levels of appellate courts doing the analysis for them as to that.
Any other questions? Your time is up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Case will be submitted.